Welcome to Beer Buzz. I'm Liz.
I'm Chris.
And today we're drinking with Tom Bly from Whitmere. So thanks for coming on the show today, Tom. We wanted to hear about how you got into brewing in the first place.
Oh, brewing. How did you get into brewing? I think I'm one of the silly stories. I stumbled into it. I actually have a degree, an MFA in fine arts, and actually worked in the software industry for a little bit as a graphic designer, and then taught in academia at Alfred as a professor. I moved out to Portland and was thinking I was going to land a job at White & Kennedy or maybe some really cool design house. And when I got here, things just really didn't work out on the creative side. And my wife saw us hemorrhaging cash and she said, "What do you want to do? I mean, forget what you're doing. What do you want to do?" And I think my comment was, I wanted to do charcuterie. And she was like, "No one's going to buy charcuterie. No one's going to buy cured meats."
When was this, mid-90s?
It was early 2000. Okay. And I said, "Well, maybe cheese." And she's like, "No, because that's like Tillamook or Ben. That's not really going to work." And I said, "Well, what about beer?" And she said, "That sounds like a really good idea. You should chase that." And so I did. And not knowing anybody, we had moved to Portland from Wisconsin. And it was just kind of a cold search. And I just called a bunch of breweries. And at that time, there were only four or five real big production breweries here in town. It was basically Woodmere, Portland Brewing Company, Bridgeport, and Full Sail were the predominant production or manufacturing manufacturers of beer. Everything else was really kind of micro on a literal level, really small brew pubs. So the first place I reached out was Woodmere of all people, and I didn't get a response. but then I reached out to Portland Brewing, and I did get a response, and that one was kind of interesting because I don't know who to thank for the entry into the industry, but three people are who I hold responsible for me being here.
And who are they?
Of the three, it's and I'm not sure which, it's either Fred Bowman from one of the founders of Portland Brewing Company. It could potentially be Brett Porter, who was the head brewer at the time, and then Alan Kornhauser, who was the master brewer at Portland Brewing. And in all honesty, it was probably a little bit of all of them. But I reached out to them, and they told me to come in for an interview. And I met Brett Porter, and then I met Alan Kornhauser, and I was asked some really simple questions. And the first one was, "What beer do you enjoy most?" And I said, "On price or on flavor?" And they said, "On price." And I said, "Pabst." And I said, "Or Huber," because I had to mention, I mean, I have to remind everyone I was coming from Wisconsin. So Huber was, I think, $6.99 a 24 pack of returnable bottles. And then he said, "Okay, well, on flavor." And I said, "Anything from New Glarus or anything from Bell's." And I said, "An occasion I'll pick up something from Berghoff." And the funny thing and the thing I didn't know is that Alan Kornhauser was the Pabst brewmaster in China, and that he had gotten his start at Berghoff, which was Huber. So I mentioned two breweries that he had some affiliation with, and I think that kind of went a long way, and it just happened to be serendipitous that I picked breweries that he had worked for and had affiliation with.
So you didn't do your homework, and you had no brewing experience, and you totally charmed your way into a job at Portland Brewing. Is that what you just said?
basically, you know, and I got in the way that nobody gets in anymore. I had no experience, but what I did say is I was willing to work for free, as long as it took for me to understand the business and for them to be convinced I might be a viable candidate in the business. And so I did that for 6 months. I worked for free for 6 months. I did all the dirty jobs. I came in, I power washed the kettle if we were switching to light stable yeast. I replaced the pads on the pad filter. I came in and did packaging and bottling runs when they needed folks on Saturdays. I racked kegs if needed be, I washed kegs, I worked dock sales. I worked every aspect of the brewery except the front of the house and in the pub itself.
What was the most important thing you learned during those 6 months?
I realized that I really enjoyed being in the beer business because it was the exact thing that I thought it was going to be and more. It was more blue collar than I could have ever have imagined. It was more janitorial work than I ever expected. The amount of CIP work was really crazy, but it was also physical labor, and it was things that you got to do with your hands all day, and you got to see the benefit of that at the end of the day. And then you got to taste the fruits of your labor, and then what was really crazy is everything went great, and you packaged it, you could even see it at the grocery store, and then you could buy a bottle of it, and you could drink it at home, and you could drink it at the pub, and you could drink it with your friends. And so the thing I've always been really, really in tune with in the beer industry is the social dynamic of beer. Beer really is a way to bring people together. When you think about the pub, orientation of pub is to get people to talk, to chat, to imbibe, to relax. And then hopefully it creates and stimulates conversation and discourse, and everybody comes out of it somewhat wiser and maybe a slightly buzzed at the same time. One of the cool stories I like to tell people too, and it's going to sound broken record, but nobody else has heard it. Cool story about Portland Brewing too is Portland Brewing, then McTarnahan's, and then got bought out by Pyramid in 2004, and then we got bought out by Magic Hat in 2008, and then we got bought out by NAB Genesee in 2010, and then that's when I segued to Hopworks, and I could tell that I knew that there was going to be another buyout with Florida Farm and Ice, and that's when I left. But I had been through, what is that, 4 or 5 buyouts, yeah. And I never left the building. Like, I literally just went through ownership change but stayed in the same place.
And that did that affect production at all, or how you guys ran the business, or was it just they wanted it in the portfolio? And that was,
you know, you have new owners, so with new owners, you always have new corporate culture.
Yeah.
You also have different attention and interest in different aspects of beer making. So, like, one of the really kind of benefits of Pyramid was that it was really, really kind of strict, but it was very SOP-driven and very, like, just process-oriented. And they had very, very high standards and a quality program that was really amazing. So it was really kind of great to be in that environment, but it was very structured. But it was a really, really kind of essential experience just because you could see what quality did and what structure did for an organization.
Yeah, you probably picked up something after each acquisition that helped you as you kind of went. Yeah. On your way into a different role.
I mean, like, Genesee was really, and NAB was really into lean manufacturing and Six Sigma. And so you take those attributes and you try to apply them. And the thing is, we're all an amalgam of all of our experiences, right? Mm-hmm. So by the time you leave, you're like, okay, well, I've got a little bit of this. I like that. I'm going to put that in my pocket. I really like this. I'm going to put that in my toolbox. And then you go somewhere like Hopworks and you go to a brewpub environment. You're like, okay, I'll take that and I'll put that in my pocket and put that in my toolbox.
Right. And after all the freaking out about recent buyouts, I think that that's a really important story to tell, because this is not a new thing.
No. No. And it's not going to change either.
What we're going to see in the industry, and I don't have a crystal ball. I can't pretend to understand what's really going to happen. But I can say that when you're around long enough, you do see little paradigm shifts and trends. This isn't new. It's happened before. There was a shakeout in the 90s. There'll be a shakeout again. And they're not going to be huge. They're going to be natural ebbs and flows to business. And there's going to be high times and low times. And people will get through it and figure it out. But we also have to remember, it's not just beer. We're also in the beverage industry. And when you're in the beverage industry, you should always keep an eye towards wine and spirits.
What advice would you give an aspiring brewer?
I think the landscape has changed a lot since I got into the business. When I first got in the business, it was a very, very young market. It was a very young industry. And I still think I'm kind of second generation or maybe even third. But now we've easily entered into sixth or seventh gen. And I think that what was really kind of meaningful back then is you just had to set an example, work really hard, and things would probably happen. And there weren't a lot of people pursuing work in the industry. I think now there is so much more competitiveness and kind of barrier to entry that at a bare minimum, you have to have a love and a passion for beer. You probably have to have a degree or some kind of certification to get into the door, and then you have to be willing to work really hard. And so I think there's a little bit of a disconnect, because sometimes people don't realize that the industry is amazing, but it takes a lot of hard work to get where you want to go, and you don't always go to the top right off the bat. So you really have to put in some time and effort and prove your worth. People have to be pretty persistent. They have to be strong workers. They have to have a hard work ethic. I advocate that anyone who really wants to get into the business, come try it for a little bit before you commit wholeheartedly to it. And if you can get an internship or even just shadow for a day and really get your head wrapped around what brewing is, not what you think it is, and you still love it at the end of the day, then you should probably jump in. But if there's a really huge disconnect between people's romanticism of the industry versus the realities of the industry.
Do you think that the ease of home brewing has fed that at all? You know, where people think like, oh, I can brew in my garage. I should be able to do this on a larger scale.
Maybe a little bit, but I think the reality is home brewing is a really good incubator. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the bigger problem with home brewing is it doesn't necessarily translate into production brewing. And so there's a little bit of a learning curve for anyone who wants to go that route. I think it would be foolhardy to think that you could simply go from home brewing and immediately go into production without headaches and challenges and some translation hardships. But I don't think that that's a real barrier. There's plenty of brewers that have made a name for themselves that started off in home brewing and figured it out.
So Innovations Brewmaster, that's a pretty amazing title to have. Tell us exactly what you're tasked with.
You know, I think the title probably is a little deceptive. I mean, innovation means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So unfortunately, it's a little broad in its scope and its kind of understanding, I think, for most people. But innovation is in the title is probably the coolest job description or title I can think of for myself. And I really honestly think I probably have the coolest job in Portland. But innovation at Woodmere is specifically a myriad of things. It really is it's multiple things. It's coming up with new product development. It's coming up with new flavor attributes and combinations of flavors that maybe we haven't explored before. But it's also really simple stuff like, and it's not simple, it's really hard. It's coming up with process improvements or maybe experimenting with new techniques. For us, sometimes it's access to new materials. There's a little bit of R&D in everything that we do, and we need to try to fold that into all of our brews that we make. Some of it's fun, and some of it's relationship, some of it's collaboration driven, but all of it should somehow advance where beer is, at least within our vocabulary or where it is in the beer landscape. So it's just progressively moving forward. I don't know that there's anything earth-shattering about what we're doing, but I do think that it's really small steps to advance beer every day. And I describe it in a really cheesy way, but I think it's totally legit. I'm on an endless pursuit to make the perfect pint for myself. And right. I'll never get there.
So how do you gauge success on a daily basis? When you go home for the day, what do you think of when you get home?
Success is probably defined a little bit differently every day. Yeah. Every context and every situation changes. We are literally making a unique beer almost every day. And it's not quite that, but it's pretty close. We're at 82 beers for the year. My goal is to be at 150 by the end of the year. We've got a new location opening up elsewhere, but the idea is that we're constantly innovating and thinking about beers and doing one-offs, and that there should be something learned through that process every single day. So maybe one day it's that I had a really successful lautering run and we got really good efficiencies, but I also got to use a brand new isomerized kettle extract that someone hasn't used yet, and I got to see how it might help soften up IPAs so that they're a little more approachable. Maybe it's using a CO2 extract so I can use less hops but have and less vegetative matter but still get more flavor and get more more fruit characteristics teased out of a hop. It could be any myriad of things. It could be successful incorporation or use of yeast. Sometimes it's just going out to the bar after you're done, after a long day, and going, I really, really enjoy this beer, and I'm not thinking about work. I'm just really enjoying the beer, and it's really, really tasting great, and I'm really happy with the results. It really just depends on the day.
So no day is the same. You walk in and out of work, and no day is ever the same.
It's never the same. I mean, my job literally is changes every single day and is fluid and dynamic and has to be. But, you know, in terms of gauging success, like any other human being, I think I probably enjoy it most when I get a pat on the back and someone tells me that they've had an amazing experience with my beer and it's a positive one that I can really kind of take to heart. But I also get a lot of value out of the days that someone tells me that they hate my beer and they just think it's horrible. So that's always a learning opportunity too. So you got to take both of those situations with a grain of salt and kind of move forward. But those special occasions are when you make a beer, you're really proud of it, you get behind it and someone validates that for you. I think there's a lot of a great experience there.
So you make 10 barrel batches, and you've made 82 beers so far this year. What happens to these batches of innovative test recipes? Who drinks them?
So all those beers make their way eventually into the brew pub. And when they get to the brew pub, 16, usually 16 of the 24 taps will always be something that came out of innovation. And it's a great way to gauge consumer engagement. It's a great way for us to actually taste them on a repeat basis so we can actually see if there's genuine drinkability to those beers. Sometimes we drink beers and they taste great for the first time out, but then you go back and revisit them and they may not be as great as you remember. And then there is a slight morphology to beer over time. After you first filter a beer, it can be very, very abrasive and rough, but over time it can start to soften up and round out a little bit. You might see some morphology that's really meaningful. So it's really nice to kind of taste beer over time. But really getting other people's perspective is really kind of important for that overall process. We even go so far as to conduct surveys and ask people what they think of the beer. And then we can generally use that to gauge interest and see if something's got clout or potential legs or if we've done something that resonates with consumers. We can also do experiments to see whether or not a New England IPA has any validity in using multiple yeast strains and if there's a preferred yeast strain for consumers. We can also use that to gauge stability. We can use that do a myriad of things. But the majority of it is to get new beers in front of people, kind of determine how successful a beer may or may not be. We get some of those beers out to the trade, but not very much. I mean, we're talking about 10 barrels, so I'm lucky if I end up with 14 to 18 kegs based on style and volume that I get out of any particular style of beer. A lot of them go to Providence Park, and that's really a great opportunity to get a broader cross-section of feedback. But for the most part, they just live in those two worlds, within the pub and a little bit of on-premise. That's it.
It sounds like you're running a real market research lab because you've got your innovations center and you've got all of these taste testers between the pub and Providence Park. So when a beer makes it and it meets all the criteria, how does it get scaled up into production and how often does that happen?
Sometimes it happens pretty organically. Sometimes it happens and it takes a little bit of time. A beer that you're drinking right now, the Portland Pils, started off in the Rose Garden, which was our original innovation center at the Moda Center, and has since moved into our four walls at the brewery. If you come into the pub and you look through the fishbowl, you'll actually see our brew house, and eventually you'll see our fermentation cellars, and you'll see us working to make these beers. And we try to communicate what beers are on tap and what we're working on to be fully transparent to folks what we're working on. But PDX Pils was probably a year in the making, so it became a pub favorite. We decided to make multiple iterations of it. We toyed with hops, we toyed with alcohol, we toyed with the malt bill a little bit. And it's a constant, endless pursuit, again, of continuous improvement. Like, can this beer be better? And then once we make it, can we make it better after that? So this is a really good example of a beer that started in ideation through innovation and then got scaled up. And there'll be a couple more that come out of that process too. Russell Street IPA, which is a pub-only beer that's named after the street that we reside on. That beer is currently only available to any other business that's on Russell Street or to Providence Park. And so it's really got this really kind of controlled environment that it lives in. But it does well enough that we're going to bring it out, and then we should see it in 2018. Things take time. And so it'll be a little while before it gets to a bottle format. But we're really excited about where it's going to go and when it comes out, and making it available to a larger audience. But even Drifter, for example, got another opportunity to come through our four walls. That beer was discontinued for a short while through SKU rat, and when it was rationalized, it disappeared for a while, but we had a lot of customers ask for it back. But a couple years had passed by, 3 years, I think, to be exact, before it came back. And in the process of that, something we talked about was that people's tastes had changed, and that beer probably wasn't going to be the exact beer that it was at the time, and that it couldn't live in today's beer landscape as the same recipe. So it's a really interesting translation equation. You simply make a beer that you're familiar with, but now you you think about how people's tastes have changed, and then you try to find out where that is in a line and then kind of make some modifications. The hop bill is amped up. The malt bill is simplified a little bit. So the spirit of the beer is absolutely 100% true to the original recipe. But it is, and so are the hops. The hops continue to be Nelson and Summit hops, but we just kind of cranked everything up a little bit because people's tastes have changed in the last 3 or 4 years.
How would you say people's tastes have changed? I mean, I think that a lot of us have noticed that Pacific Northwest breweries in particular are starting to back off the really hop-forward bitter IPAs, that people are looking for more sessionable beers, more clean German styles, or at least more balanced IPAs in general. What, from your point of view, since you're the innovations master and you're watching this changing landscape, getting beers thrown back at you to retool, what are you aiming for? How would you describe the landscape right now?
I don't think there's one.
The tastescape.
The tastescape is full flavor. People just want quality. And I think that at the end of the day, if you make quality beer, you don't have anything to worry about. You're always going to be in a pretty good position. People want full flavor that delivers on flavor. They want to know what they're drinking, and it has to be good. It has to be qualitative, but it has to just taste good. I think there's a rising tide in that there's a lot of breweries making really great beer. That's like a bare minimum to what we need to do to make and help the industry out. But I also think that if you look at trends, there's kind of things happening on multiple levels, and none of them are the magic bullet and the one swift answer to success. New England IPAs are very polarizing. You either like them or you don't. But at the end of the day, I think that they're here to stay. I think they're really flavor-driven, and because they're flavor-driven and they're qualitative and they're actually really good, they're going to stick around. People, consumers will buy them, and the consumers are the ones that ultimately decide what styles are going to be and what trends are going to shake out. We as brewers end up having to follow those decisions, and more often than not, they're the right ones. But you know, New England IPA is a really good example of something. If you talk about IPAs in general, I think the West Coast helped shape some of this. The New England has kind of come in and come full circle to even ease some of that into a more balanced IPA drinking arena. It's definitely fruit forward. It's not as bitter as it used to be. And I think that that whole desire for a bitter arms race is over. I think that piney is probably something that has lost some of its traction. I think people just really want to pick out flavors that they can identify with. Lagers are definitely on the uprise. We've seen this over the last 5 or 6 years. 2 or 3 years ago, there might have been 3 or 4 craft lagers on the scene. Now everyone has one. We have Portland Pils, but we have friends at Bowie, we have friends at Breakside, our friends at Frame, friends at Hopworks. Everyone's got a, you know, can't forget Heater Allen, who were the folks that were really doing it. There's a lot of people working in that space. If you went to OBF this year and you looked at what was happening, Ezra called this out, and it's legit. Mexican lager seemed to be the thing that everybody was kind of interested in. We produced an American lager. I think there's a lot of desire to kind of create sessionable, drinkable beers that are really, really, really well-crafted. Sours weren't really on anyone's radar 5 or 6 years ago, at least not in a meaningful way. Now it's become a part of the common language of every person that's a beer connoisseur. Dry hop sours, Berliner Weiss, I mean, you see it everywhere. The rise of cucumber beers, I mean, where did that all come from? But all these things are going towards really, really unique flavors.
So, Tom, tell us what we're drinking today.
This is a classic. This is what started it for the Widmer family. It's Hefeweizen. It's an American-style Hefeweizen, but it has a lot of the attributes of the Bavarian style in that it has some isoamyl. It has a really nice citrusy quality. It's not as phenolic. But it definitely is a really great classic American example of what Hefeweizen should be. And I think a lot of people can enjoy it. It's just a really quaffable beer.
So lemon or no lemon?
I'm no lemon, but at the end of the day, it can certainly be enjoyed with a lemon. I'm an equal opportunity enthusiast when it comes to beer consumption. I think this might be the Hopworks influence on me, but I really try to make sure that I'm inclusive about beer consumption. I'm not really someone who's a beer snob to the point of saying you can't do something or it only should exist a certain way. I think I'm one of those guys that just really, as long as people are enjoying it and treating the beer right and respectful of the beer culture, then I'm always going to be okay with it.
I'm not a stalker, Tom, I promise, but I do follow on Instagram and I see that you do collabs like every week. So. Yeah. Do the beers that you collaborate with other breweries with, do those go on tap and do they have the potential to become high production Widmer beers or are they just part of your innovation process? Tell us about how the collaborations work in your innovations lab.
Collaborations are really interesting, right? Like collaborations mean a lot. It's just like innovation, collaboration means different things to different folks. Sometimes collaboration is about the process, and sometimes it's about just mixing people together and deconstructing beer, but trying to figure out how to retool it together. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's learning something from someone else and then applying it to that beer, and then you give them hopefully something in return, and they learn something from that beer. Generally, I try to put myself and partner myself with collaborators that I'm either friends with, and there's a relationship that I want to kind of expand upon. And I know we're going to make a great beer. But a lot of times it's also folks that I want to work with that do things that I don't do very well. Like I'm not necessarily particularly gifted at making sour beers. It's a little bit of an uncomfortable zone. So obviously I would, in my desire as an improving, like someone who wants to improve on an ongoing basis, is I'm going to partner with someone who does that really, really well. It's going to put me in an uncomfortable space and I'll hopefully garner some learning curves through that. Widmer is really rad in that they do collaborator series, right? So we've worked with the Oregon Brew Crew, and we do 3 collaborator beers a year. Some of those have, you know, gone on to become products like Noel Blake's Steel Bridge Porter that was scaled up and became a beer. Snowplow started off as a collaborator project and became a beloved seasonal offering. So there's this spirit of collaboration within the Widmer DNA that started with Collaborator and OBC, and we still have this outstanding commitment to homebrewing and support of homebrewing. But it also transcends that into these collaborations in industry and outside of industry. I was really fortunate enough to work again with Christian Ettinger, who's a really good friend and a great colleague. We got to make a beer together, and that was absolutely just 100% fun, and the beer is going to be awesome. But I also have experiences that really are learning opportunities. And I just worked with Kieran and an extension of Kieran at Spring Valley Brewery. It's their innovation arm. They came in and they presented hops to us, Murakami 7, that have never been used in North America before. So when you talk about the education component of collaboration, and that's what it should be at the end of the day, you should get something out of it that helps further and advance your education and your experience.
So you have the good fortune of doing a lot of collaborations. I'm sure that there are some real standouts, great outcomes, hilarious stories. Tell us about some of your favorite collaborations as the Innovations Brewmaster.
You know, what's funny is I actually used to not enjoy collaborations because they took a lot of my time and bandwidth, and you have to be on point, and you have to be a host, and you have to take care of people, and you have to like let people into your brewery and like touch your equipment. And so those things used to like challenge me a little bit. I'm not saying I'm a control freak, but I've come to really enjoy them just because, one, I really started to embrace the relationship side of it and just enjoying the moment. Like just really kind of understanding that it's a snapshot in time, right? Like it's never going to happen again. Like I gotta really get my head around the idea that I just enjoy that moment. We're going to have a really good end result, and hopefully the product's going to be rad. But I'm okay with the process. I'm just okay with like the journey, not necessarily getting to the destination sometimes. And then the destination ends up being kind of a nice afterthought, and it ends up being added value. But like last week I was joking, like I thought I had enough of my collaboration filling in. I'd done like 3 in 3 days. But then I was joking. I was like, no, actually, they were rad too. So let's just do 5 in 5 days. And then I joked and said, well, F it. Let's just go ahead and do like 14. Let's see how far we can push this. How many collaborations can we do in a day?
Before you lose your mind.
Before you go crazy, right? And the thing is like, I'm not always doing them at our place, although we do them at Widmer quite a bit. But doing them in someone else's space is kind of interesting too, because talk about discomfort. Like now it's new equipment that you're not used to. There's a learning curve behind that. You may not like the way that they're doing something, or you may think that there's challenges to the way that they're doing something, and you want to insert yourself and like fix things, but you can't. And then all those things are really, really hard. But you know, you also realize that there's a lot of shit that you don't have to worry about, that we shouldn't sweat the small stuff. If we don't pick the fly shit out of the pepper, the beer will be fine. But like working with Salt and Straw, that's a really good experience, right? Because that's somebody that's not beer industry, but you get to know a little bit more about Tyler. You get to understand how he sees flavor and how he approaches product development and innovation. You know, that's the other thing. Innovation is happening all the time with all under other industries, and if you can learn from them, that's really cool. But we made a beer with him, and the beer is awesome. It's just crazy good. It's a grapefruit IPA with lactose, and I just want to drink that beer all the time. I think it's just awesome.
I was going to ask you, what's in your fridge right now?
That's a question I will not answer, just because I think it's loaded and unfair. What was in it last night was I had some of my own beer, but I also had some Occidental Kolsch, and then I also had some Modern Times Hoppy Wheat. You know, there should be a little bit of everything in your fridge. That's the right answer, but you know, it depends.
Yeah, well, it is 107 degrees here in Portland today, so there is a cold Willamette Valley Pinot Gris in my fridge. I'll admit it.
If you're drinking beers, you should be drinking nothing but Kolsch and lager.
I agree. Yeah.
Maybe some session IPAs or pails.
Yeah.
How much do you think being in the city of Portland has contributed to your collaborations? You know, like you mentioned Salt and Straw. There's obviously a ton of breweries here. How has the city, you know, contributed to that?
This city is, I loved this city when I first moved here because I always thought it was do-it-yourself. I talked about that blue-collar ethic of the industry, and I think that that's what kind of inspires people to want to come here. I think it's part of the reason why the brewing industry is so rad here. I think it also helps that we have such great proximity to ingredients. Bull Run Water is unmatched. You have Willamette Valley and Yakima, and so you have a source of hops that are immediate. You're getting hops literally within a couple of hours, or if you're ordering them, they're showing up next day. So there's nothing like that experience. Most of our malts all coming from Canada or from Great Western, just across the river. A lot of us are using European malts as well, but at the end of the day, there's this really great terroir that we're getting from localized ingredients.
So what is this? What is this collaboration that we got here?
So that collaboration is, I'm actually calling it Kirche im Dorflassen. It's a mouthful. I know.
Translation, please.
Right, so here's the other kicker.
You got 10 years of French. That's it. Let's go. I got the petite IPA.
My mom's German. My dad was a GI. And so I was born in Germany in Augsburg, and some half my family's still there. And so Christian and I really geeked out on this connection with German heritage and culture. We both geek out on lagers. Both of us really, really enjoy them. We like to make them if we could. I think we would be making them all the time and nothing but lagers. Very much in the German tradition where you might have like one or two or three beers in your portfolio and that's it. But we talked about brewing. He wanted to make a lager. We happened to have like three lagers on tap. And I was like, well, you know, maybe we switch things up. Maybe we do a German pale ale. Hopworks is really well known for their hoppy IPAs and hoppy beers in general. And we're kind of on a Kolsch kick right now. We have a Haha, which is a smash beer with organic two-row and Nelson hops. We just did a beer called No Lederhosen, and we're calling it a Rhinish pale. But when I was talking to Christian, I really like the idea of trying to take this Kolsch kick we're on and then take the hoppy character of Hopworks portfolio and kind of smash them together.
Nice.
And so this is our take on a German pale ale. It's a German pale malt with a little bit of dark Munich, a little bit of carapils, and then we hit it with nothing but Hulmelon and Mandarina hops. But we used a ton. I mean, an F ton. It's a lot. Like I started off and it was like maybe 2 pounds per barrel. And Christian's, I think, direct quote was, I want to break your brewery. And so we ended up just throwing more and more hops at it. And so we ended up at somewhere close to 5 pounds per barrel. But it doesn't taste like it. It still tastes really, really clean. So hopefully you enjoy it.
So Tom, what can we expect from your innovations lab over the next year?
I think you'll expect to see more of the same. We'll just be exploring as many styles as we can and trying to figure out how to expand on that conversation. Expect a lot more barrel aging from us. We kind of took a little hiatus from that, and that's kind of coming back. I think that the barrel age flavors are really kind of nuanced and really sophisticated and elegant. And I think people are really appreciative of those things. We just came out with a barrel aged triple that was aged 9 months on Pinot Noir barrels from Stoller. There was one that was reminiscent of my mom's peach pie. It was basically peaches aged with that triple. There was another one that we made with raspberries, and we're calling that Immer Himbeer. And so in German, that would be always raspberry. I also was fortunate enough to take some beer that I made with a Belgian brewer from La Aragon. He's a guy that makes a contract brew with Depruv. He makes a Belgian IPA, and we took some of that we made when he was in the States and worked together on a collabo. I took some of that beer, put it in Pinot barrels, aged it on juniper as well, and then after that age for 3 months, I put it back in the bright tank, dry hopped it again, and then we put it back out, and that was called Gondolin Returns. So we're trying to finesse all these flavors and trying to find complexity. That's a really good example of something that you should see more of. We're going to try and get as many different types of barrels as possible. And if all things work out well, you'll probably see more kettle sours from us. You'll also start to see a really, really small portfolio of wood sours because I'm not very good at, or it's not a comfortable space for me, so I'm going to put myself in that space.
Good for you. Yeah. Way to keep pushing and learning.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to just make one style of beer. We want to get, well, you know, good at making every kind of style that you can. And, you know, if I gauge the success of a brewery, it's never through specialization, although breweries do have a place there. But I'm always really, really enamored with breweries that show a really diverse portfolio and make beer in general really well. Really good examples for me are really Breakside and Freem. Like, those guys know how to make a breadth of products that all taste really, really good. And I think that should be a call out for all brewers is let's make sure we're really making a portfolio and a breadth of beers that are really amazing. Let's not just get into a place where we're making one or two really great beers. Let's make a lot of great beers.
Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Here's to our art degrees, to pushing creativity and innovating in the beer world.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers.